Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, September 26, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, our conversation will be on executive power under the Antiquities Act, begging the question, can designated national monuments be altered or rescinded? My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Todd F. Gaziano, who is a Senior Fellow in Constitutional Law and the Executive Director of the Pacific Legal Foundation's D.C. Center. Also with us is Professor Mark Scolacci, Professor of Law of the Natural Resources Law Center at the University of Colorado Law School. After our speakers give their remarks, we will turn to an audience Q&A. Thank you both for speaking with us. Mark, the floor is yours to start.
Thank you, Wesley. And I'd like to begin my comments by talking a little bit about the background and history of the Antiquities Act. I'll try to do that quickly and then move into the question that you've posed for Todd and myself. So it's important to understand sort of how we got to where we are with the Antiquities Act. It began because of concerns about looting on our public lands right around the turn of the 20th century. And the looting was taking place not just by amateurs, but also by professionals and museums that were trying to take these artifacts, primarily in the southwestern United States, off of the public lands. In the year 1900, three bills were introduced to try to stop this. They were sent to the committee that was chaired by John Lacey, the House Public Lands Committee, and Lacey sent these bills over to the Interior Department for feedback. Interior responded with its own bill, essentially trying to push the sort of scope of these laws, not because they weren't concerned about looting, but because they wanted a more expansive authority that would even include, under their bill, the authority of the president to designate national parks. Over several years then, a compromise was ultimately worked out that included language that was in the original Interior bill that allowed the president to designate objects of historic or scientific interest. So the laws passed in 1906, and Teddy Roosevelt is president, and he loses no time in beginning to exercise his authority under the Antiquities Act. He begins with Devil's Hole National Monument in Wyoming, and a couple years later, he designates what may be one of the more important monuments, not just because of what it was, but also because of the litigation that it precipitated, and that was the Grand Canyon National Monument in 1908. So Roosevelt designates the Grand Canyon. More than 800,000 acres are designated, and it raises questions about the scope of the Antiquities Act and whether the president can designate such a large landscape as a national monument. The problem that arose was that an Arizona politician by the name of Ralph Henry Cameron had some mining claims along the Bright Angel Trail, which is the main access point from the South Rim to the bottom of the canyon. And his claim sort of ran afoul of the Santa Fe Railroad Company, which had built a hotel at the rim of the canyon. And the patrons of the hotel were hiking down Bright Angel Trail, were passing through the mining claims, and Cameron was charging them a dollar to get through. The hotel got upset, complained to the Interior Department, which ultimately determined that Cameron's claims were not valid. This incensed Cameron. He eventually became, by the way, a United States Senator from Arizona, and so he had some political power. But Cameron still lost his claims and ultimately challenged the decision to designate the monument and took his case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the reason this is important is because the Supreme Court really did confront this question of the scope of the president's authority under the Antiquities Act and essentially said that, look, the Grand Canyon is clearly an object of scientific interest. It's one of the greatest eroded canyons in the United States, if not the world. And so it had no trouble confirming this broader scope for the Antiquities Act right from the get-go. Now turning, if I can, for a few minutes to the more significant question that we're confronting today, which is whether or not the president has the authority to modify or revoke monuments that were previously created. And let me suggest from the start that in my view, he does not. And I want to explain why I take that position. the whole analysis starts with the fact that the power to regulate public lands is congressional power. It's under Article 4 of the Constitution. The Supreme Court has said that Congress's power over our public lands is plenary authority. The Congress can delegate that power, but the delegation is limited to the terms of the enacting legislation. And in the case of the Antiquities Act, Congress delegated to the president the power to reserve lands, federal lands, as national monuments, did not specifically give the president the authority to modify or revoke those lands. Now, you might say that, well, the power to reserve encompasses the power to modify or revoke, but in fact, Congress had passed two other pieces of legislation that were contemporaneous with the Antiquities Act, and on either side of that law. So in 1897, Congress passed the Forest Service Organic Administration Act that specifically gave the president the authority to designate and proclaim national forest lands and to modify and revoke designations that were previously granted. Similarly, in 1910, Congress passed the Pickett Act, which also gave the president the authority to withdraw lands for certain purposes and also to modify and revoke those. So it seems that the Congress fully understood how to give the president broader authority. Since the president is exercising delegated power and that delegation has to be construed narrowly, it's my position that the president only has the power to reserve. It's one-way authority. And I think there are good policy reasons for this. If you think about what's going on with the Antiquities Act, we're talking about protecting lands that the president believes are important to protect for future generations and to protect the resources that they contain. Congress can always reverse those designations, and in fact has never done so with any significant proclamation that the president has declared. Indeed, of a large number of these monuments that were proclaimed by the president have been designated as national parks by the Congress and expanded to encompass the parks. So you can think of a wide range of these parks that include, of course, Grand Canyon, Zion National Park, Acadia National Park in Maine, Olympic National Park in Washington. There are a whole host of our national parks that began as national monuments, thus confirming, I think, the wisdom of the enactment of the Antiquities Act in the first place. One other piece of legal analysis that I think is important here is what happened in 1976. So in 1976, Congress passes a law called the Federal Land Policy and Management Act. It's the broad authority for the BLM to manage our public domain lands. And in that law, Congress addresses specifically the authority to withdraw lands for a variety of purposes and repeals most of the legislation that had previously been granted to the president and other executive branch agencies the power to withdraw lands. But it does not repeal the Antiquities Act. Now, there's some confusion in the legislative history about what Congress intended, specifically because they have a provision in Section 204J of FLTMA, which basically says that the secretary cannot modify or revoke national monuments that have previously been declared. It was odd language because it the president or the secretary never had any authority in the first place, so it was odd to suggest that he couldn't modify or revoke. But in fact, what happened, I believe, is that the Congress was considering turning over that authority to the secretary. There were objections from the president about the decision to do that, and so in the end, they did not turn over the Antiquities Act authority to the secretary, and that vestige of that that earlier proposal seemed to remain in the law. The one important point here, though, that I want to emphasize is that in the legislative history, in the final House report that became FLTMA, for the bill that became FLTMA, Congress explicitly states that it's their intention to reserve for themselves the power to modify or revoke national monuments. So I think that the law is reasonably clear on this point. It was one-way authority. It was specifically intended to be one-way authority. And if there was any doubt in 1976, that doubt should have been put to rest by the enactment of FLTMA.
First of all, I want to thank Mark. We have been exchanging quotes and reading each other's work. I'm going to point out the work that John, you and I have been doing on this, but I get a little bit more clarity on some of his argument, and I'm going to maybe try to press him on one of his points. But I think I'm going to try to mostly address the legal issue and then work in a few policy responses, and I'm going to begin with some broad constitutional principles that, John, you and I write about. And I'll mention to our very educated lawyer listeners that Mark and his co-authors, I think, main piece is at online at the University of Virginia Law Review, and is certainly worth a read. And John and my piece was accepted into the Yale Journal of Regulation, but it's available on SSRN, and its title is Presidential Authority to Revoke or Reduce National Monument Designations. So now the constitutional principles. I think we have two strong constitutional principles that both point to the president having authority to revoke or revise monuments. And then I'll go through the statutory reasons why I believe there's a strong case to be made for that as well. But I noticed one Mark was quoted in the Washington Post for seemingly opposite propositions. So let's begin with the two that John and I rely on. One is there's a strong proposition in British and American constitutional law that one branch or one government or even an executive cannot bind a future executive. So one branch can't diminish the power of a future parliament. That's the British parliamentary phrasing of that. Ours is the same. One Congress can't take away the power of a future Congress. One president can't take away the power of a future Congress. One Supreme Court can't say we're going to rule in a particular way and no future Supreme Court can reverse that. So that's one strong proposition. The other strong proposition, at least in American constitutional and statutory law, that we cite lots of authority for, maybe it exists in Britain and other Commonwealth countries as well, is there's a strong presumption that any grant of power, either in a constitution to a branch or from Congress to an individual like the president, any grant of power includes the power to reverse or modify. So that's the presumption. Now, before I go through some of those examples, it was just this morning that I noticed a quote by Mark in the Washington Post, and maybe he can tell us he was misquoted or taken out of context, but here's the quote from Mark. If we allow presidents to second-guess the judgment of their predecessor, there would be no end to the mischief that would create. Well, I think that's actually the mischief that one president can do by reversing another president is what we call democracy. So I'm hopefully going to invite a clarification from Mark on that one. But now let me go through the sort of textual response. The text, its drafting of the Antiquities Act, its history, and certainly the practice under it, including the very early practice, including by Taft to cut one of his own monuments in half. There's no implication in that act that the power to create monuments did not include the power to withdraw it. Second, such implication that the power granted is unilateral and doesn't include the power to withdraw doesn't exist in any other statute ever that we've been able to find. So if Mark is to prevail, Mark and his co-authors are to prevail, it will be the first statute in all of American history where silence as to the whether there's an express power reversal means that there is no express power for reversal. There just isn't a case like that. But, of course, John, you and I, have cited counterexample after counterexample where silence means implies the power to reverse. Congress doesn't have express power to repeal statutes, but, of course, it can. It just uses the same procedure. The president doesn't have express power to remove appointed officials, even if they were required to be Senate confirmed, but we know in Myers versus United States famously that the Supreme Court said he does have that power. He doesn't have express power to abrogate a treaty, but plurality of the Supreme Court, and that's been the practice. The president can unilaterally do even what he must do with the Senate. Court doesn't have express authority. to overrule itself, but it does. But that's also true for statutory grants. We cited several examples, and probably the most important is the power to issue regulations. If Mark's theory of implied power being lacking, and I think in some of his writings, I think he does a very good and clever job to say, but the purpose of the Antiquities Act is different because it's protective. It's to protect land. But the same is true of almost every grant of regulatory power to almost every regulatory agency to issue regulations. And when those powers are granted to the agencies, normally the Congress doesn't add, and these rules can be repealed or modified. And there was a test of that in the D.C. Circuit. Now, unsurprisingly, the D.C. Circuit said, well, of course the power to issue regulations, even protective ones, ones to protect our health or whatever these regulatory agencies are supposed to do, does include the power to repeal them. Finally, even if Congress expressly tried to deny a future president the power to undo a grant of power that an earlier president does, that would raise serious constitutional questions, because they would implicate those two constitutional principles I began with, and therefore, if it's an unclear case, the court's going to apply that standard doctrine of statutory interpretation to the Antiquities Act or any other act that says if there's any implication the president doesn't have the revocation or modification authority in the statute, we're going to read the president to have it. Finally, 18 presidents, you know, the practice issue, 18 presidents have reduced prior monuments. None has revoked it, and I'll be really disappointed if the president doesn't revoke at least one. Pacific Legal Foundation, I hope my colleagues are listening, sued the president or his officers when Obama created the most recent monument in the Atlantic Ocean on the high seas. This is 130 miles to 200 miles from the American coast. We represent a lot of fishermen who are wrongly denied their ability to fish, by the way, fish sustainably under the fishing laws, and instead they are forced to engage in fishing on a smaller and lobstering on a smaller territory, which is even less sustainable. So the wrongful creation of this monument is actually harming the environment. But policy issues aside, the authority of the Antiquities Act is to designate lands, and lands that are owned and controlled by the United States. By control, I think they were thinking of the Indian Trust lands in the Southwest at the time, maybe Alaska, since Alaska was not a state. So sort of control of less than ownership. But no one owns the seabed in international waters. So the Northeast canyons and seamounts is flatly illegal, and we hope this president revokes it rather than just lifting the fishing limitations. And if he just lifts the fishing limitations, I think we will try to continue to have it overturned as a legal basis. But for most of the history of the Antiquities Act, there are different periods. So this is where I differ from Mark in the history. There are periods of abuse and periods of minor quiescence, and then periods of abuse that exceeded the previous period. In the most recent period of abuse, we thought that President Clinton, you know, set the records, and he did. We thought no one could beat the abuse of President Carter. Clinton beat that in some ways. But Obama, George W. Bush, by the way, was no piker in abuse, but Obama shattered all records in the hundreds of millions of acres of land. One of my colleagues, Jonathan Wood, has a blog post on Liberty Blog that shows an almost asymptotic rise in the amount of federal land that's denied multiple public use and designated for supposedly scenic and scientific views. That really is also an abuse of the original purpose of the Antiquities Act. Mark was right that it was to protect against looting, but it was only supposed to be a temporary power. He misreads the legislative history of this 1976 statute, but the 1976 statute did something else. It allows the Secretary of Interior to temporarily withdraw from public use any area of land, but only for 3 years. That serves the emergency purpose to protect looting. And then it allows Congress, our people's representative, 3 years to decide what to do with it. Most of the people who argue that the monument's creation is only a one-way ratchet did so thinking that there would never be a president who would want to reverse it. What they should have done is engaged in compromise in Congress, because by eschewing compromise in Congress, they make these national monuments that they wanted, this area in the national monuments they wanted to protect, more vulnerable. Let me briefly end with response to the Pickett Act and the FLPMA readings. John, you and I have read the same laws that Mark and his co-authors have and come to the opposite conclusion about them. For example, he mentioned two laws around the same time as the Antiquities Act. One of them really did grant both an express withdrawal right and a revocation right. That's a sort of belt and suspenders approach. It doesn't mean that whenever Congress didn't include the withdrawal right, that it automatically meant the president didn't have it. As I said, there's no single case in all of American law that stands for that proposition. The only authority, by the way, and I'm remiss in mentioning it, is there was a 1938 Attorney General opinion by Attorney General Cummings that came out on Mark's side of this legal question. John, you and I have sort of almost exhaustively pointed out the errors. He relied on an 1862 Attorney General opinion, which actually came to the opposite conclusion he thought it did. But if the president is going to act, I think, to significantly reduce monuments, he will certainly have overruled that Attorney General opinion. But I think no court has ever relied on it, and I don't think any court ever could after John, you, and my examination of it. The Pickett Act of 1910, and I think I'm now exceeding my time, I'll just leave for maybe the next response, I think proves the opposite of what Mark has read. And the same is true for the Federal Land Policy Management Act. I think it proves that Congress knew how to limit the Secretary's authority over reductions or revocations of monument, and that proves that Congress, by not limiting the President's authority, was just reconfirming the original understanding of the Antiquities Act, that the President has it. But I think that act strongly supports the underlying theory that John, you and I have taken, but I'm still not even sure I understand his argument, so I'll pose this one under that one. If he argues that the Antiquity Act legislative history changes the Antiquities Act, a later statute's legislative history can't change an earlier statute. If he thinks that confirms the underlying interpretation of his interpretation of the Antiquities Act, then I think a later Congress's, particularly a House's, ambiguous legislative history can't change the interpretation of another statute. But I'll let him respond to that, and certainly with that, I'll turn it back to him.
Okay, thanks, Todd. Lot to cover here, so let me just try to tick off a few things. First, I'm perfectly happy to defend.
I'm sorry, Wesley, but do you want to? Since I took a little extra time, I'd slightly like to hear give Mark a chance to respond first.
Of course, Mark. Please take your time with your response.
Okay, I hope not to need all my time, but let me. Let me start in by looking at the comment that Todd made about the Washington Post comment, and I was about to say that I'm perfectly happy to stand behind that comment. Here's my concern about allowing presidents to start playing around with monuments that have been previously designated. If this were allowed to go forward, we're going to see presidents one after the other from different parties changing the nature of monuments back and forth, protecting lands, unprotecting lands, protecting them again. And one of my concerns, frankly, and this is where the congressional role becomes important, one of my big concerns is that when presidents like President Trump decide to shrink the size of something like a Bears Ears monument, they're essentially inviting the public to come in and use the resources, perhaps degrade the resources in a way that protection of those lands may no longer be possible. And that seems to me to cut right against the goal of the Antiquities Act to protect these resources as the original president sees fit. That's a policy argument. I'm perfectly happy to see it that way. But the legal arguments, I think, are what are obviously more important here. And I think what Todd and John tend to ignore in their analysis is the fact that we're dealing with delegated powers here. This is power that comes, as I said in my opening remarks, from the property clause. The president doesn't have any authority over public lands unless the Congress gives the president authority over public lands. Now, in the context of the Antiquities Act, the president has done so. So using examples like congressional authority to legislate and then modify legislation is totally an apposite. It's irrelevant because, of course, Congress has the power to legislate. That's part of its constitutional power under Article 2 of the Constitution. So that's just kind of that's really not relevant to this question of what the president can do when the power has been delegated from the Congress. Similarly, with regard to regulations, the APA is crystal clear that agencies have the power to both adopt regulations and defines regulations to include the repeal or modification of regulations. There's nothing surprising or earth-shattering about the idea that agencies can engage in two-way kinds of regulation and pull back on regulations that are already there. That has nothing to do, again, with the kind of power that was delegated under the Antiquities Act here. So I just don't find those arguments compelling. Todd makes this argument about the sort of broad powers that somehow are binding future executives, but Congress can do that if it wants to do that. Again, this is congressional power. We're not binding the government. We're binding a president and authorizing the president to do things in one direction and not the other. And Congress is perfectly free to do that since it has the authority in the first instance to do that. I want to talk briefly about the comments that Todd made about the fact that 18 presidents, I don't know if it's 18 presidents, but certainly 18 monuments have been modified. And in a couple of cases, those modifications have been significant. And the important point to mention here is that none of those decisions was ever challenged in court. So we have no idea what a court might say about the decision to modify these monuments that were done previously. I would point out, by the way, that the most significant change that was made, that I believe was briefly referred to by Todd, was in the Mount Olympus National Monument. Teddy Roosevelt, 2 days before he left office, had designated more than 600,000 acres as the Mount Olympus National Monument. And in 1915, Woodrow Wilson basically cut that monument in half, or nearly cut it in half, taking out almost all of the timbered area of the particular monument. Arguably to support the war effort, it wasn't entirely clear what the basis was. Certainly there was a call from the mining and logging industry to cut back on the monument, and perhaps that was the reason it was done. But the point here is that there never was a challenge to this. And the more important point, I think, is that ultimately Congress decided to create the Olympic National Park and put almost all that land back in the national park that was originally in the monument, suggesting that it should have stayed there all along. It's really important to point out how successful the Antiquities Act has been. You talk about the congressional authority to change monuments, it almost never does it. There have been a few minor monuments that have been abolished by Congress for reasons that are really beyond the scope of this call. But the important point here is that no important monuments have ever been rejected or rescinded by the Congress, even though we all can see that the Congress has the power to do that. And so this notion that somehow because presidents have done it and it's never been challenged in court, that that somehow sets a precedent that we can't now call back is just kind of silly. I think that it's going to be tested in court if Trump decides to shrink or rescind any monuments. We'll see what the court has to say about it. But I think there's a compelling argument that this authority is really only one-way authority. Just a couple of other things I want to sort of point out here. Todd mentioned the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts National Monument and suggested that there's no authority to designate these because they're not federal land. What the Antiquities Act requires is that they be on lands that are owned or controlled by the United States, and the Office of Legal Counsel has issued an opinion making clear that lands in the exclusive economic zone, that is the lands between 12 miles and 200 miles out to sea, are under the control, under sufficient control by the federal government, that these are lands that can be designated under the Antiquities Act. That's a subject that could be debated. It may very well be litigated, but there's a fairly compelling argument that's backed up by the legal opinion of the Department of Justice that suggests that presidents have the authority to designate these lands as a national monument. Finally, Todd talks about the sort of legislative history and the whether or not the Federal Land Policy and Management Act can do anything to change the nature of the Antiquities Act. I think it's an interesting point that he makes about whether or not the Antiquities Act has somehow amended whether FLTMA has amended the Antiquities Act or whether Congress is clarifying the authority that already there under the Antiquities Act. And those are subjects that I'm guessing the court will confront. But I think the important point that I wanted to make here was that Congress was actually legislating on the question of the authority under the Antiquities Act. There is language in Section 204 of FLTMA, which deals with these withdrawals, which, as I said, talks about the authority to rescind and abolish. And importantly, the Congress specifically, the House report on the bill that became FLTMA, specifically, it's not ambiguous in any way, shape, or form. It specifically says that the Congress is reserving to itself the power to modify or revoke national monuments. I don't think that you can deny that the Congress has that power. After all, as I pointed out, this was power that comes from the Congress in the first instance. The executive branch, the president, only has the authority that has been delegated to the president under the Antiquities Act or under some other legislation that delegates that authority. Ultimately, the full authority over public lands is in the Congress. That's what the Constitution says. That's where it remains unless and until Congress delegates any of that authority to the president or some other executive branch agency. Okay, I'll stop there and turn it back to Todd.
Well, thank you. I think we are getting a little bit of clarity. First of all, I think Mark is wrong to say John and I don't understand the nature of Congress's power over federal lands and that presidents only have a delegated power. We fully recognize that, but the Antiquities Act, of course, delegates to him both the power to create and revise monuments. The analogy to grants from the people to Congress, I do think is apt because Congress only has the power in our federal constitution. Sometimes people forget that it's delegated by the people, but when we the people delegated to Congress the power to create laws, we implicitly delegated the power to revoke, and that's why the constitutional analogies are apt. The president, Congress, and the Supreme Court in our system, not necessarily some other constitutional system, only has power delegated by the people. But I don't think that all the other statutory examples we've cited are distinguishable at all. The D.C. Circuit case that I mentioned upholding that agencies do have implied power to revoke did not turn exclusively on the Administrative Procedure Act. The Administrative Procedure Act says how you repeal a statute if you have that authority. The challenge in the D.C. Circuit and the challenge you would make to any other is whether the organic law that gave these agencies the protective power that is analogous to the power to protect national monuments includes the power to change those regulations. And the D.C. Circuit said, of course, the organic statute, unless says otherwise, contains that power. I thank him for correcting me if I misspoke that 18 presidents have revoked. There were 7 presidents. I have a handy-dandy list of who they were. But we discussed at some length a very interesting one by Eisenhower that the Supreme Court actually sort of passed on in an odd way that was involved a bay in Alaska. But his reasons, Eisenhower's reasons that we discussed for reducing that are quite fascinating. One was that he thought that some of the land was mistaken. Another is he thought that it was already used for military purposes. So, in other words, presidents can just declare higher use, a military use, for example, for these national monuments, and therefore reduce them. And the Supreme Court didn't directly address the president's power in that case, but they didn't, you know, deny it. That the presidents often pick beautiful scenic land to make national monuments that Congress later made into a national park, I think, is irrelevant to the legal issue of whether the presidents were abusing their authority in the first part or in usurping Congress's power, or whether the president has authority to reduce some earlier presidents. I don't know why he thinks that an earlier president's determination, as reflected in his Washington Post quote, is privileged, as the academics would say, over a later president's determination, that all of that, those 100 million acres or the, you know, 1.5 million acres in Utah, are necessary to protect some small scattered monuments. As a policy matter, in the paper we do raise some questions with the theory that a larger boundary is always more protective. If you're in a war zone, for example, you're trying to protect some people, your green zone is smaller. It's not necessarily, you don't try to create a green zone around the whole country. But that's a policy argument. I think Mark is mistaken, and we cite 2 examples where Congress did override president monument decisions. One happened to be the Grand Teton area. Wyoming not only changed those designations and made some a refuge and some a national park, but also prohibited the president from ever using the Antiquity Act again in Wyoming, I think more than 5,000 acres. There was a similar response in 1980 as Reagan was coming in between Carter's loss and Reagan's election in Alaska to address some of Carter's worst abuses of the previous year. And again, Congress not only changed many of them, you know, they engaged in compromise in ANILCA law. I'm trying to remember what all the acronyms are. But it also then forbade the president from ever using the Antiquities Act again in Alaska. So 2 states other than 5,000 acres. So Congress has fixed the abuse as to 2 states. I never knew why it didn't fix them as to other states. Mark is right that a prior OLC opinion did say that the United States has sufficient control over international waters to, you know, invoke the Antiquities Act. He didn't say the Fifth Circuit rejected that. But our litigation, our paper and our litigation shows the holes in that prior OLC opinion. I'll side with the Fifth Circuit over OLC. But finally, as to FLTMA, this is the Federal Land Policy Management Act of 1976 that Mark thinks somehow supports his side. I'm going to quote the text, since we are textualists, the text of the act. The secretary shall not, dot, 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 and then there's 3 things he shall not. The secretary shall not, dot, 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 modify or revoke or any withdrawal creating national monuments under, and then it cites the site for the Antiquities Act. So the text of the act says the secretary shall not revoke or withdraw. I think that means that Congress knows how to say who can and who cannot. And if they wanted to, if they were trying to prevent the president from withdrawing or revoking, they would have added the secretary and the president, or neither the secretary nor the president. But the legislative history, as I say, is ambiguous. But you never turn to even an ambiguous legislative history from one house, I should add. One house's legislative history on a different version of this act to try to contradict the clear text in the statute. I know there are many people who would like to try, and many of us are probably employed from time to time to try, but as a principled matter, that shouldn't be done.
Maybe real quickly, I just take umbrage a bit at Todd's characterization of Carter's monuments as abusive. Carter designated 56 million acres in Alaska as national monuments, a bunch of different national monuments in that decision, and it was partly because these lands were about to be opened to the operation of various public land laws, including the mining law, for example, that could have compromised the protection of these lands. And just 2 years after Carter designates the monuments, Congress passes the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA, and protects over 100 million acres, including the monuments that have been protected by Carter. So in many ways, what Carter did was really in aid of congressional legislation, and some of the protections that the Congress was able to put in place were only possible because Carter had acted earlier. And just quickly about the Jackson Hole National Monument, I mean, it's a really interesting story. We don't have time to get into it in a lot of detail, but the monument was designated by Franklin Roosevelt after a donation was given of about 30,000 acres of land in what's now the Grand Teton National Park from John D. Rockefeller. And the Rockefeller gift was essentially calling on FDR to protect a larger landscape as a national monument in that area, which FDR ultimately did. And it's true that Congress then passes legislation that forbids new monuments in Wyoming, and it was partly because there was such an outcry in the state of Wyoming, the kind of thing we're seeing now in Utah. The Wyoming delegation adamantly opposed to it, hearings, the threatening to overturn the entire Antiquities Act. Cliff Hansen, who was at the time a Teton County commissioner, later became U.S. Senator from Wyoming, ran a cattle drive illegally through the new national monument. And what's, I think, so important to recognize, this isn't a legal argument, but I think it's important to recognize that Cliff Hansen and Al Simpson, all the others who opposed the original monument, have now or later admitted that they were wrong, and that, in fact, Jackson Hole was the best thing that ever happened to Teton County in that area. So I think we're seeing views changing in Utah as well. Go down, anybody who has spent time down in the Grand Staircase Escalante area knows full well how that monument has fundamentally changed in a very positive direction the economy of that region. And, you know, it's ironic, I think, that the state of Utah advertises with a multi-million dollar campaign its mighty five national parks without acknowledging that four of those five national parks began as national monuments. So I think it's just important to keep these things in mind as we debate whether or not the Antiquities Act should be allowed to operate as it has in the past. Okay. I'm ready for questions.
Let's go ahead and move now to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our audience to submit questions, just one question for our speakers. Can President Trump narrow his own designations? If so, why is that substantively different to the narrowing decisions made by, I guess, former presidents in the same office?
I think any president can narrow anyone's authority, so I'm interested in hearing what Mark has to say about that.
Yeah, Taft did it with the Navajo National Monument. But that was partly because, and I have no problem with this, Taft did it because the original proclamation was grossly unclear. It did not have the kind of legal description that would let anybody know what was actually being protected. And so Taft amended his original proclamation to clarify the legal descriptions for the monument. And I think that I'm perfectly willing to concede that if a monument proclamation basically says it's protecting a particular object and the object is outside the boundaries, or if the legal description for the original monument is unclear so that people can't know for sure what is included or not included in the monument, that those kinds of things can be corrected. But beyond that, I do not believe that a president can correct his own or anybody else's monuments. I think that's a job for the Congress.
I suppose that does remind me of another question or another side issue I'd like to respond to. The argument from practice doesn't fall apart just because it wasn't challenged. I mean, there is the dog that didn't bark issue. If no one challenged it, maybe they didn't think the president's authority was improper to reduce them. And as I said, there are many other presidents, including FDR, that reduced significantly some earlier monuments. But the argument from practice is that these presidents, particularly in the early history, understood that was their authority. If you've got no authority on the other side, and there is no authority on the other side, then there's at least some weight from practice. But, you know, my position, I think, is supported by text, legislative history, practice, constitutional principle, a lot of, analogies and nothing on the other side.
Thank you both. We have one question in the queue. Audience members, if you'd like to ask anything, just please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone keypad to enter the queue. Let's move to our first audience question.
Hi, this is Jeff McCoy from Pacific Legal Foundation. So I have a question about Section 204J of FLIPMA. If, as Professor Scalaggi says, if Section 204J of FLIPMA applies to the president, then under standard canons of statutory construction, wouldn't that mean that the rest of Section 204 applies to the president as well?
Yeah, so thanks for the question, Jeff. It's not my claim that Section 204J applies to the president. I think that my own view is, and again, I think the legislative history is ambiguous about what happened, but there was early discussion in the lead up to the Federal Land Policy and Management Act about whether to delegate the authority under the Antiquities Act to the secretary. And it's my belief that the language in 204J was a vestige from this early effort. I mean, if you go back and look at what was happening at the time, the Public Land Law Review Commission had essentially recommended that all of the withdrawal authorities, including the Antiquities Act, be basically taken away from the executive branch, except for the authority in 204J. And so that would have been the only authority. And so at the time when they were looking at it from that perspective, 204J may have made some sense. But I think ultimately President Ford, who was president at the time, objected, or his staff objected to taking away this authority from the president. It didn't happen. And as I pointed out, I realize that some folks are unwilling to look at or consider legislative history, but if you are willing to look at it, if you are willing to consider it, you could not find a more clear statement from the legislative history about what Congress intended. It's explicit. They intended to reserve for themselves the power to modify or revoke national monuments. They don't talk about the president or the secretary. They talk about Congress, and the Congress says it reserved that power to itself. So I find that compelling. We'll have to see what a court decides.
Oh, well, I didn't ask my colleague to ask that particular question, but I'm glad he did and got your response, because I've never understood your argument from the statute before. But now that I do, it seems even weaker. So if you concede that the text that I read, which I thought the legislative history was supposedly referring to, doesn't deny the president the authority, since it only applied to the secretary, then what you're left with is a standalone legislative history statement expressing some hope. And I will quote it in full so that our listeners can hear it. The House committee report, so it's not a joint committee report, at an earlier stage said that the statute, quote, would specifically reserve to Congress the authority to modify or revoke withdrawals for national monuments created under the Antiquities Act. I think what that must mean is it must refer to the statute, since that's what it's saying, and that it is as between the Secretary and Congress, Congress has the authority. But let's say that the legislative history drafter, this rogue staffer, really intended his legislative history sentence to repeal and revise the Antiquities Act. If that's your argument, then legislative history can't do that. And I think we all know that, and I think we all know how the court will treat that argument.
The queue is open for audience questions. So again, if you'd like to ask one, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone keypad. And while we wait for any more questions, I just want to announce that our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, September 27th at 3 p.m. Eastern. It will be on the White House extending and expanding the travel moratorium. Please keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone conference calls. And our website has a calendar of these calls, as well as a catalog of previously recorded podcasts. You can also find this call recorded and uploaded in about a day's time. The queue is currently empty. Again, callers, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key before we end the call. Is there anything, just to continue the conversation, Mark, is there anything that you would like to ask Todd?
No, I think I've pretty much covered what I'd like to talk about.
Thank you. And Todd, is there anything that you would like to ask Mark?
Well, I suppose I'll respond to his last response about Congress protecting certain former national monument abuses in national parks. And it goes back to his original description of the drafting history of the Antiquities Act. The Roosevelt administration repeatedly tried to sneak into the Antiquities Act authority to designate national parks, and Congress repeatedly denied it. And in many of these other statutes, Congress has wisely and jealously guarded its power to not only create national parks, but you know, other types of wilderness and protective status. That says nothing about the original abuse. And if it wasn't seen as an abuse in 19, when President Carter did it and when Franklin Roosevelt did it in the Jackson Hole Monument that's been now renamed Grand Teton and other parks, I submit that Congress would not have amended the Antiquities Act to deny the president the power to ever act in those two states again.
I don't know. Let me just say that I'm not sure that you can read anything into those amendments to the law. First of all, the ANILCA doesn't really talk about, this is the Alaska legislation, doesn't talk about the Antiquities Act at all. It doesn't specifically amend the Antiquities Act. It just says that the president basically can't make further withdrawals in Alaska, which would include Antiquities Act withdrawals, presumably. The amendment to the Antiquities Act in Wyoming was clear, but it was done at a time of huge anger. The Congress, the members of the Wyoming delegation in particular, were so angry they refused to fund the operation and management of the Jackson Hole National Monument, and a compromise was ultimately reached that allowed the money to go forward with the agreement that the law would be amended to take away that power. I think if the monument were to be designated today, you might see a different response. It's hard to really know. I don't think you can read anything into the fact that the law is amended. Nobody's denied that the law was amended in the context of Wyoming and that the amendments in Alaska did have an impact. I would sort of emphasize, though, that was done in the context of protecting over 100 million acres, much of which was begun by the Carter administration's designation, by President Carter's designation of 56 million acres in Alaska as national monuments.
Well, I would then support or urge you to support the democratic process in Congress more if you think it'll get better results. But the fact is the Utah delegation was considering a compromise that would have permanently protected much of the area that that was in Bayer's ears, but that compromise was unacceptable by those who wanted more, more, more. And that's when they stopped negotiating, seemingly in good faith, and went to Obama and asked Obama just to designate, you know, 1 million-plus acres. That was their mistake, because to the extent we want to protect these lands, they are now vulnerable to President Trump's reduction or any future president's reductions, unless and until our elected representatives actually make, by law, those protections permanent.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it depends on what the court has to say about that question. But I guess I would say that I thought President Obama exercised a fair amount of care and discretion in designating Bayer's ears in particular. The original proposal, I believe, was for 1.9 million acres of land to be protected. Obama decided to designate 1.35 million acres for protection and specifically cut out some areas where he thought there were potential conflicts with mineral development and other kinds of uses. So true, it's a lot of land that was protected, and we'll see whether it stands the test of time. I mean, the problem, and again, this is not a legal argument, but from a policy perspective, and I don't think you can ignore the policy here, these monuments turn out to be wildly popular throughout the country and even in the states where they're originally designated. And I don't think we can just ignore that. I mean, obviously, as Todd fairly points out, you know, these are legal issues that are going to be resolved by the courts. But it's really hard to ignore the popularity of these national monuments and the goal of protecting them. In my mind, the Antiquities Act has probably been the most successful conservation law ever enacted, probably anywhere in the world, because of the way that it operates, allowing the president to designate and to do it, in my judgment, in one direction. And I think that's going to be important to maintain over time. We'll see what the courts have to say about it. But I don't think you can deny that the legacy of the Antiquities Act is one of conservation of very important lands for not only this country, but for the world.
I agree with you that our national parks are popular. My wife and I have spent many of our vacations the last 10 years exploring and hiking, particularly in the West. But that's an argument for Congress. That's not an argument for unilateral action. If you really love this land, if it's really that popular, then you shouldn't have run to Obama, you shouldn't have run to whomever to clearly abuse an act that was intended to, legislative history makes clear, the Antiquities Act protect the works of man. Yes, some of them were scientifically interesting. And one of the other things you haven't mentioned, I'm sure you know, of the history, the early history of the Antiquities Act would have limited it to 320 acres, and then another version, 640 acres, and the dastardly Teddy Roosevelt administration convinced them that, oh, there might be some special case where we need a little bit more than 640 acres. Don't be so persistent. So we'll put in this phrase, which is the equivalent, the smallest area, the president can only designate the area that's the smallest area necessary to protect this landmark or work of man of scientific interest. And that was the you know, camel's nose under the tent that later presidents thoroughly abused. Congress was hoodwinked. They should have stuck to 640 acres or 320 acres. They were hoodwinked. But the argument that these massive monuments are anything other than an abuse, and that some, like the Northeast Canyons Monument, isn't flatly illegal, I think isn't very plausible.
Yeah, you know, so let me just start with an area of agreement. I mean, I think that Todd and I fully agree that Congress has authority to do whatever it wants to do with our public lands. And I have no problem with that. I mean, the fact here is that Congress delegated this authority to the president. Presidents are allowed to designate national monuments. And I am totally on board with the idea that if Congress wants to pull these back, I hope it doesn't. But if it does, it can. It can shrink them. It can abolish them. It can do whatever it wants. The fact is, of course, they haven't done it with any significant monuments, in my judgment. But but that power is clearly there. I really take issue, though, Todd, with you when you talk about abuse and hoodwinked. That's not what was going on. Look, at the time that Congress passes the Antiquities Act, Teddy Roosevelt is president. There was no fooling the Congress about what Teddy Roosevelt might do with a law that gave him the authority to designate objects of scientific and historic interest. And he follows that up pretty quickly. Roosevelt designates 17 national monuments in the less than 2 years that he has left as president, including, as I've pointed out, more than 800,000 acres as the Grand Canyon National Monument and more than 600,000 acres as the Mount Olympus National Monument. Anybody in Congress who didn't think Roosevelt was going to exercise that authority was not paying attention. I mean, Roosevelt was the guy who was designating all these national forests that caused so much heartburn among some parts of the West. And so it's just silly, to my mind, to suggest that somehow Congress was hoodwinked or that presidents have been abusing this power. In fact, the language that is included in the Antiquities Act, the language regarding objects of historic and scientific interest, it was part of the original bill that would have allowed presidents to designate national parks. That was part of the interior legislation. And the ultimate bill that came up was a compromise. And they specifically took out the reference to 320 acres or 640 acres and the language that would have limited in that way. That was specific. And again, the idea that somehow the Congress didn't understand that Teddy Roosevelt wasn't going to run with this, I think is just doesn't reflect Teddy Roosevelt's history or what he might do with this kind of authority and what I think everybody understood when the law was passed.
I think what they did is they used language that they thought would limit Teddy Roosevelt, because they knew of his abuse under the forest, designating forest land, but they didn't choose they were hoodwinked and not choosing very good language. And the reason I say that is because they did have a huge fight, as you confirm, over whether the president could have authority to designate national parks. But your theory is that they denied him the right to declare national parks, but just in name only. What they decided to do was give him the authority in the Antiquities Act to declare $800,000 national parks like the Grand Canyon, which the Congress later ratified by actually making a national park. But you believe that he had authority to create national parks except in name only. That would be a silly act. That just isn't true to the Antiquities Act's legislative history. See that they wanted to limit it to 320, 640 acres. Roosevelt tricked them into thinking we might need a little bit more, you know, maybe 1,000 acres, but leave it open. Put in this other limitation language. That'll be good enough. And then he ran with it.
Well, a unanimous Supreme Court disagreed with that analysis in 1920 when it ruled in Cameron versus United States. So,
Cameron case did not resolve the size issue. That issue in Cameron, as you know, had nothing to do with the size of the designation. The party in question was just talking about his pre-existing mining claim.
Doesn't matter.
The Supreme Court passed on the size issue. The Supreme Court has never passed on the size issue.
The Supreme Court made crystal clear in the Cameron case that the Grand Canyon was an object of scientific interest. It was specifically addressing the language under the Antiquities Act. And it clearly could have gone to the smallest area compatible language had it chose to do so. It didn't do it. Cameron, by the way, clearly wanted
them
to go.
Because Cameron didn't have standing to raise it. He didn't have standing to raise it, and he didn't raise it. He couldn't raise the size issue. His claim was not for 800,000 acres. So he didn't raise it in the case of the Supreme Court.
I don't think that's right, Todd. I mean, if you have standing to challenge the monument, you have standing to challenge the monument. And if he thought it was too big and shouldn't encompass his mining claims, he could have raised it. But I don't think the court
raised
the case
the is size to raise the too big issue, and he didn't. And even if he might have had standing, he didn't. That's not what the Supreme Court.
But you don't need to worry about it, Todd, if in fact the court specifically approves of essentially a landscape level monument, which is what they did with the Grand Canyon. They said it's one of the greatest eroded canyons in the United States, if not the world, and therefore it is an object of scientific interest. Bam, we're done. at that point, there's no point in getting into the smallest area compatible because the canyon is a big area, right?
I'm certainly glad Congress declared it a national park, but if the Supreme Court had seemingly approved of its size as a national, by the time the Supreme Court was ruling, it had become a national park by Congress. So that's another reason it didn't address the size issue of the national monument. It was made a national park in 1919, I think. The Supreme Court case was what, 1920? The Supreme Court would have no reason to question the size issue. But if it had, it would have been dicta. That just isn't an issue that was part of the court's holding. And the Supreme Court has never ruled on a proper size challenge. That is one of our second claims we're bringing against the Northeast Kingman and Seamount, but it's a lesser one. The presidential abuse in the Pacific is even more breathtaking, even more hundreds of millions of non-land that's declared to be a national monument land.
Well, I apologize for being the bearer of bad news, but it looks like we've come at the end of our teleform time. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank Mark and Todd for the expertise and their valuable time today. We welcome all listener feedback at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.